First of all, I should say that this is an oral history with Jerry Cott, and the date is November 26, 2006. And Jerry, do you mind if I ask you your date of birth?
February 7th, 1925.
Okay. And where were you born?
Yonkers.
Yonkers, New York.
Yonkers, New York. Uh-huh.
And so how did you get to Mill Valley from Yonkers?
My mother was born in San Francisco, and she left San Francisco when she was 9 years old. Her father was a vice president of a company called Cluett Peabody. They invented the Samfurized shirt system. And so they were quite well known.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a promotion that made him move to New York. And so we heard, she was 9 years old when she left, so we heard lots of stories about, it rains orange juice in California, and there's good weather, and there's no snow, and on and on and on. So after World War II, we had wanted to leave Yonkers, but we had ties, real estate ties, and during the Depression you couldn't sell anything. You were lucky to even own it, much less. So there wasn't any way. We were just prisoners of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And when the war was over, things had changed, the market had changed, things were getting off the ground, and we thought before we put any roots down again, let's all move to California. So my mother came out here to look for a house. She flew out. And she remembered coming over on a ferry to Marin County, and she thought, I'll look over on that side first. And she went, somehow found her way to San Anselmo. She entered an ad, a real estate ad or something like that. She went to San Anselmo. And she found a little house up there that she liked and thought would be a good buy and appropriate. I was married by this time. My brother was divorced many, many years ago, and my mother brought up his two children. And he wanted to kind of get away from his ex-wife, so they grabbed the kids and moved to California. So that's we came out here. Now, when I came out, I towed a house trailer from New York. I used my mother's car.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got here, the only trailer park was in Alto. So we went into that trailer park. It was $12 a month. Garbage included, showers with hot water, and that's if you had your own trailer.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how we got to Mill Valley, and it was a beautiful little town, and you had everything here that you needed, and we never moved further.
So what year would that have been?
It would have been 1940. Let's see, World War II, I think, was over in 45, wasn't it, or was it 44?
45.
45. Well, it'd have been 46. Could have been late 1945, but more likely, because the war ended in June, if I remember correctly, the European
mm-hmm.
part of it did,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So we...
So you came out here, you said you were married, and you have... and.
I was married in the service after I got out of the service, and to Margaret. We weren't allowed to marry. The Austrians were considered the same as Germans.
So you had been in
in the European theater.
Oh, I see.
I was in the 877th Airborne Engineers. Now, I don't know if you want me to talk about that.
Oh, sure. Particular.
Well, it's an interesting story because You know, World War II, it was a gigantic effort. And the right hand didn't always know what the left hand was doing. But, you know, you'd have to forgive that because this was such an immense undertaking. I was drafted. I didn't finish high school. And I was drafted when I was 18. Went to New York City. Went through a physical, which, you know, was just a day of walking around. Everybody was going to pass, more or less. And then we went in and took the oath of, you know, the allegiance to the government and to the army. And after we got through, this was a big auditorium full of people. I mean, there must have been, 200, 300, 500 people in there. And the sergeant was stood up on the stage and, you know, he gave the big speech about when your grandchildren ask you where you were in the big war, you can proudly say you were there fighting for your country. And then we took the oath, and then he said, okay, everybody can go home for 2 weeks, and you'll get a postcard in the mail, and then you come and do what you're told, or you'll be AWOL. Now, if there's anybody here that has a trade, would like to learn a trade, what goes to a trade school, please stay after the rest of you leave. Well, I thought, yeah, I'm in a trade school, and I'm trying to learn a trade. And so I stayed. Most of the guys that laid were older people. You know, they weren't 18. They were more like 40 because they had a trade. They were either, you know, carpenters or plumbers or whatever. So I couldn't quite figure out why they would ask a thing like that, but I stayed. So he gave me this address, and he said, go down there in the next 2 weeks, go down to New York, and here's the address, and they'll sign you up and explain everything. So I still couldn't quite fathom why I was going to do this, but I did it. So when I got down to New York, I went up to this big office building and ushered into a big room full of desks, everybody busy working there. And the girl sat me down and she said, well, where would you like to serve? And I thought, where would I like to serve? I thought the idea was we were going out to kill Hitler. I don't know about where I would like to serve. Well, wouldn't you like to be close to home? Well, yeah. Well, we have a school up in Westover Field, Massachusetts, and it would be 36 months or 36 weeks or some such thing, and you have to volunteer for it, and, oh, yeah, well, that'd be great, you know, I could come home on weekends, yeah. So I signed up for the 877th AB Engineers, went home. Reported as I was told to, went down to Long Island and got our uniforms and stuff. But me and another group of fellas were just pushed aside, and we didn't have to do a lot of the testing and things that the others had to do, because we were already assigned to an outfit. So you didn't have to take aptitude tests and things like that. So in 3 or 4 days, they put us on a train to Westover Field, Massachusetts. And we got off the train on the other end, and there was a big sergeant there, huge big fella, with a clipboard. And he said, okay, all you airborne, line up over here. Well, I'm not no airborne. Finally, he comes and says, hey, kid, what's your name? I go, oh, yeah, well, right over here. No, I'm not an airborne. I'm not jumping out of no airplanes, not me. Yes, yeah, son, you're right here in the Airborne's, 877th Airborne Engineers. Oh, I was terrified. I thought, I'm not going to jump out of any airplanes. Well, it turned out they were glider troops, and that didn't bother me at all. So we went to Westover Field, Massachusetts, and we were there for about 2 weeks. We were replacements. This outfit, there were three battalions, the 877th and I think the 876th and the 879th, something like that. But the battalions were never close to each other. They were always in a different location in the States. So we didn't know anybody from the other outfits. And the principle was this. They had these gliders, and you could put a Jeep inside of them. They were pretty big. They were made by piano, of all people, piano companies, made out of wood with a canvas, tight, stretched canvas over the outside. And they were kind of disposable. You never figured to use them twice in combat. You landed, and the thing was destroyed. And if the people were in it, if they lived, well, then they got out and did their job. And our job was to cut down the trees. This would have been designed for the Pacific on an island. Cut down the trees, and with these little bitty toy bulldozers that we had inside, we'd smooth out some things, and then the C-47s would fly in with the troops, and we'd take over the island, and that was the scheme. So they held a mock battle between the other two battalions. And the generals came down from Washington to see how practical this whole idea was, and they came away and said, this is totally a fantasy. This isn't going to work. These little bulldozers, you could stop them with the palm of your hand. They hadn't developed the little engines like they have today. So, you know, they just said, you know, put these guys back in the service, put all this equipment in the scrap heap. We need scrap. But they forgot to cancel our battalion. They just simply misplaced the whole thing. And we went to Europe. Our colonel just took us to Europe, and we drew rations and got paid and everything. But we were never attached to any higher authority. So our colonel had complete control over us, and we just moved around. We went from different air bases, and we got little maintenance jobs, you know, cleaning out the outhouses and patching up the holes in the runway and stuff like that. And then when we felt like it, we'd get up and move someplace else. So we went through the entire war without any of the people that were running the whole thing fully realizing where we were, what we were for. It was absurd. One time, when we got to France, after D-Day, we got to Cherbourg, but I can't remember the beach, Omaha Beach, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And we landed on D plus 31, so things were pretty calmed down. We could still hear the explosions and the fighting, and where it was all kinds of prisoners being marched back and forth and stuff. And we went out onto the Cherbourg Peninsula. That's all we owned at that time, 30 days after the invasion, was the Cherbourg Peninsula. And they had all of these fields out there that were separated by thick hedgerows, been growing there for years. They were supposed to be impenetrable, but you could get through them. You could crawl through. And each of these fields had a different purpose. The one next to, we weren't supposed to leave our field. You're going inside in the gate, and you're supposed to stay inside this thing. But, of course, I didn't stay inside. I was a cook, and I had extra time. And every time I had a day off, I'd sneak through to see what was going on around me. And I finally got through one time. They had in the orchards, they had stacked all kinds of crates of ammunition and spare auto parts, and they just used the whole Cherbourg Peninsula as a warehouse, because without all that equipment we couldn't have really won the war. And I went by coming in that way. I was in the back of a headquarters place that ran this whole thing, and there was a bulletin board, and on the bulletin board there was a list of all the different outfits and what their particular, some of them were for they could build pontoon bridges, and some of them could string telegraph wires and so forth. And I said, oh, look, there's the 877th Airborne Engineers. And it said, a rusty wheelbarrow and a sheep's foot roller? Question mark, question mark, question mark. I went back and I used to be friends with the supply sergeant. We got to be good friends, Sergeant Kenny. And he in turn had a speaking relationship with the company, with our company commander. I didn't. And so he went and told him, yeah, Jerry was out there, and he said, and our company commander was just a regular little Boy Scout, and he was just incensed that we that our very capable, dedicated group should be so downgraded as to just be question mark, question mark.
Well, that's a different kind of war story. So you started to say that you must have met your wife while you were there.
Well, after the war, when the war was over, I was eventually taken out of the airborne outfit and put into, when they had the Battle of the Bulge, which was just before the war ended, this was Hitler's last push. Mm-hmm. They needed people on the front, and they said, hey, take all these slackers back here that are just support troops, and they got to take three men out of each company up to the front. And so I got picked for that, and the day before the war actually ended, I was on the front, was up to the front to go to the battle. Mm. I had no idea. We had gone through three months of infantry, tough you up, you know, go through basics again, and get you all set to go for the infantry. And then we got put into these boxcars with hay on the floor, and we went on up in. This was all the training was done in France. And then we went up to, I think it was Wiesbaden, Germany, and that's the end as far as the train lines could get us. And from there we went by truck on up into Austria. Past Linz, Austria, and then halfway to Enns. And now the Roosevelt and Stalin and Churchill had agreed that the Americans wouldn't go past the Enns River, and the Russians could come up that far. Well, we got to the Enns before the Russians got to their side of it. But at that time in the war, everything was over. It was just complete total chaos. The German soldiers were trying to give up, to surrender to somebody, and nobody wanted them. Here I come up to the front lines, a scared kid, never been issued any ammunition. And what do I see coming towards me but a whole bunch of Germans? Nobody seems to be excited about it. And these guys would come out and they would surrender to you. And we'd say, well, I don't know where to put you. I don't know what, you know, leave me alone. It was just total chaos. Eventually, we got put in a sort of like a holding transit place, just a house. They just took over the whole village, all the houses, and put soldiers in them and put the civilians out in the street. And I was sitting at home writing a letter to my mom when I heard, you could hear this commotion, you could just hear a general noise level going up, and I looked out the window, and I'm looking out at a central court where maybe five different streets entered into this central plaza. And I was curious, and I went outside, and I started to get surrounded by American troops, and there was a Jeep was an American Jeep, but they were was manned by Russians. So we knew that if the Russians were there, there was no more fighting in between. You know, so everybody was Americans were saying this is good news, and of course, the Russians didn't want to go any further, and so there was just a whole bunch of hugging and breaking open the bottles and stuff like that, and finally, somebody next to me said, I'm going to follow him. I want to see. This is a historic moment. I want to be there when we get to the meeting spot. And so I had no permission to leave or do anything. I just jumped in this, happened to jump in this Jeep. And the Jeep ahead of me was the Russians going back. And all of a sudden, the Germans had blown up any piece of equipment they could to stop the road from being used. So they would park their tanks and their artilleries and everything else out on the road and blow it up. And now we had the most gigantic tow truck that you can imagine. And they just went down this road, shoving everything off the road, pulling it off the road, but opening up for traffic. And all this mountain of iron tanks and everything else was just on the sides. But as we proceeded down the road, we started to get to the part that didn't have all the stuff taken off yet. We passed the tow truck and we're weaving in and out of these vehicles very slowly. And all of a sudden, the tail lights of the Jeep up in front of us switched around and it was headlights. So, you know, the driver put on his brakes real quick. And when we got caught up to them, that they had hit one corner of their fender on a tank and spun the vehicle around. So you always carried a little first aid kit on your belt, and you're always told you never use your first aid kit on anybody else. That's for you. Well, this Russian was there. And and there was blood running down all over his face. Well, you know, the slightest little cut, and it looks just terrible. He wasn't really hurt bad. So I quick opened my bandages up and sprinkled this sulfur or whatever the heck it was in there and bandaged his head up. And he got his stuff out of the Jeep, and a whole bunch of guys turned around and picked up the Jeep and moved it around, got it back on the road. And by now, all these other GIs in back that were following, they'd stopped and were walked up to find out why it wasn't moving. And the Russian broke open a bottle of vodka, you know, and poured some out and asked me to drink with him. And I didn't drink at the time. And I said, no, I don't drink, you know. Well, he was kind of offended. And he was two sheets to the wind. He'd already been drinking some before. You know, I don't blame him. This war was over for them, and he knew it. And eventually, a young kid came up that spoke Polish, and Polish is enough close to Russian that they could communicate. And the Russian said, well, why won't he drink with me? And he asked me, why won't you drink with me? I said, well, tell him it's my religion. And I don't know how else to explain it. And so he told him that, and he said, boy, that must be a strange religion. Oh, okay. And he picked me up and put me in his Jeep, and he got in the back, put his arm around me, and we drove. And as we were driving along, here comes all the Russian army. And, I mean, they were the most beat, draggled, dirty, tattered. I mean, I looked at these guys, and here we are with our crispy, clean uniforms with the pleats all pressed in the front and everything. And these guys had been in the war. They weren't out there cooking food or playing around like I was. And wow. Well, it turns out the next morning when I got back, I made it just back in time to not be missed as the... I heard somebody saying, I'm going back, and I said, hey, I'm going with you. And it was hard to drive in the other direction, very slow. But I made it just as they were having roll call, And I snuck in. I just got in these big doors, and I heard him call my name out, and here. And it turned out they wanted us, since we were going to meet Russians and they were our allies, they wanted us to show the proper respect. So they showed us the insignias, and it turns out that this fellow that I had helped was a general, but he wasn't a big general. They used the term general in their service. In it's sort of the equivalent of a colonel in our service. I guess it makes them feel good, you know, oh, you're a general now, but you only can have this authority. So it's like, now you could, they have generals that are the equivalent of our generals, but mm-hmm. but it goes by the number of stars. Mm-hmm. So it turned out that he was a general, and I have no idea what his name was or anything like that, but he was the first one. He was in the head of, when we left that night, the streets were, every little village that we came to, it was just still burning. There were dead horses laying in the streets. And the Russian soldiers that we saw going through there were drunk as they could be. They could hardly stand up on their feet. They were screaming and hollering and singing, and they must have got into a hardware store someplace, because they all had brand new hickory pick handles, just the wooden handles. And they were smashing everything they could find, even though it had all been broken already. You know, if there was something in the street and it was broken, they got there and smashed it into smaller pieces. And hooping and hollering and so happy, you know, that they'd made it through. And that was the end of the war. The next day, it became official. End of the war.
Wow. And so at that point, you would have met your wife at some...
She had fled Vienna because the girls were afraid of being raped and stuff, and so they didn't know what to do, and a lot of them went with the army as the army left. Now the Germans were smart enough to know that they better not get captured by the Russians. So there was this tremendous effort to get across the Enns River. Mm-hmm. When my outfit, I can't remember the name of it. It was an infantry outfit, 65th. I'm not sure. But our job was guarding the German prisoners. I mean, we weren't the only ones doing it, but we were guarding the certain ones. And these Germans, they couldn't give up. Nobody would accept them as prisoners. So what they did was they went down and dug some holes, put some posts in the ground, strung some wire up, and went in the inside and locked themselves up and said, well, now we're now we're prisoners of war. Take care of us. We want to be protected under the Geneva Convention. And at night, they had a guard tower on all the four corners. And at night, I was a cook. I had been a cook in the 877th Airborne Engineers. And so when I came into the outfit and the captain talked to me, he said, well, we'll make you a cook here, but we can't do it for a month or so while we transfer out some other people. So we would go up on guard duty, and the Germans had 3 bullets, and we had no bullets. They never issued us any ammunition. And I'm glad they didn't. I'm afraid, you know, somebody would have got hurt. But it was kind of funny to be standing there. They put one German and 2 Americans. And the German had 3 bullets, but the Americans didn't have any.
It's still recording. There's
a lot. Well, that's about... for Margaret. I met Margaret. Now, Margaret had gotten across the Enns River, and there was a refugee camp there, right close to where we were. And, of course, young girls and soldiers always got together somehow. Mm-hmm. And I learned to speak German real fast. and I eventually... Now, the war was over, but it was just a matter now of getting men home, and you got home through a point system. You got a certain number of points based on your age and based on your marital. If you were married, you got more points. If you had children, you got more points. And then you also got points depending upon how many campaigns you were in. Well, technically, we had passed through three places where we were to be included in the campaign, although we didn't lift a finger to fight in any of them. But we got the credit. So then they started to switch people around from one outfit to another so that they would have everybody in the same outfit would have the same number of points within a few points. That way they could ship big lumps of people home at once. So I left Enns and went in further into Germany. I can't remember where. And I went back and brought Margaret down to where I was. I don't know if you want me to get into all the details, but...
I was just curious how you met, and then you came to America. I'm still going to get you back to Mill Valley.
We weren't married yet, and I had to get married, and they wouldn't let us get married. So there's a... In order to accomplish that, I'll skip a big bunch, but I got discharged from the service. And I got discharged from the service under the pretext. I got to start further back. Eventually, I got Margaret, I smuggled Margaret with me to various places, and one of them was up to Czechoslovakia.
You actually smuggled her?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, you had to. They didn't let you carry you. You know, yeah, but for various ways, I got her in a boxcar for 14 days, and she got there on the other end, and sometimes I dress her up like a soldier and just bring her right along. But our company people, they were, you know, they called me in a couple of times, and I said, how come that girl happens to show up? Well, she's got her own papers. I was a scallywag. I was just a kid, you know. But I soon found out that the Army really doesn't know what it's doing. I wanted to get some Christmas cards printed with my photograph on them. And for the old used coffee grounds that we throw away, the printer was willing to print as many things as you wanted. And I suddenly realized, he doesn't really know what he's printing. He'll print anything I give him to print. So I made up this imaginary card that said U.S. on the front with a big eagle. It was cardboard and would fold in half. And inside it said, it gave the description and a photograph of the person, and it was countersigned by Colonel somebody or other. And it said, please extend all the courtesies of your regime to this person and requested by so-and-so. She can eat in the mess hall, and she's allowed to travel in the vehicles. No nonsense. But I hardly ever got to use the things. I just got them because I thought it might be great way to move her around. But when we left Czechoslovakia, our company was, it was the day before Thanksgiving. We were on the road Thanksgiving Day. That's just a few anniversary, just a couple of days ago. So they had told us, now you cannot smuggle any of these people out of Czechoslovakia. This is going back to the Russians. This is their zone, and there was going to be a mass exodus. All Americans were to leave in one day, and the Russians would swoop in behind us. Well, Margaret slept in a little village in a little town where we were, and for Thanksgiving Day, that's one of the biggest days for the cooks. We prepare turkeys and stuffing and everything. But we had to have it, the celebration, the day before, because we were going to be on the road for Thanksgiving. So we, after we served the meal, we had to break down the kitchen, put it on the supply truck, ready to leave real early in the morning. Well, we got all our stuff on this truck, and there was so much stuff that the wooden staves that went over the top wouldn't hold it all, and they had to just take the tarps off and put the tarp over everything and pull it down to hold everything on that truck. It was that full. Well, I went up into town, and that evening, there were a whole bunch of Czechoslovakian people that came around, and they just begged for help to leave. And I gave out hands full of these passes. I don't know whether it had helped anybody to escape or not. I don't know, but I never saw them again, and I have no idea. Real early in the morning, it was probably about 4 o'clock, maybe earlier. Roughly about 4 o'clock. And I brought Margaret into the where I slept. Earlier that night, when these people were asking for all these for help, mess sergeant, he didn't really care for me, and he didn't care for Margaret. So we didn't have a good relationship, and he started firing his pistol out the window to get these people to leave because he was thinking they were going to steal something out of his truck. Then he stuck a lamp like this just out the window so he'd have some light out there. Now, I got to get her in that truck. He's going to ride in that truck. But it's the only hope I could see to get her out. So I dressed her up like a soldier, put on helmet liner and jacket and all that stuff. And we came, got her in there, snuck out to that truck, took the rope off, threw it back over one corner up by the front of the cab, got up in the truck, and I took out two cardboard cases full of GI soap to wash the dishes with. And I took some turkey drumsticks and other meat, put it in a bag, shoved her in that little hole, scrunched on down like that, pulled the tarp over her back and tied it off again. Now, the cooks weren't going to ride in that truck. That was just a single truck. It had a trailer in the back. We were going to ride on a big, big semi-trailer with the whole company of men. So I wasn't going to be in that truck and take care of her. And, you know, it started to snow. No sooner got her in there and a few little snake. Well, by the time it was time to get up and breakfast was being served and stuff, we only served hot water for coffee. But her back was melting the snow in a circle on the top of the truck. And I was just frantic that maybe they were going to find her in there. Well, I didn't find her in there, and nobody, of course, paid any attention to this little melted spot on the top of the truck. Now, it was so cold that when we left and got into the line, the caravan, I could never see either end of it. I could never see any end to the taillights in one direction, nor could I see any end to the headlights in the other direction. Every so often, they had huge fires. They had trees, whole trees. So like the fire would be 50 feet long. And they'd let a certain number of people stop and warm up and then get back in the caravan again. And by the time we got to the other end, which was near Frankfurt on Main in Germany, we were following, and every once in a while, her truck would stop. It had motor trouble. It would stop, and then it would catch up, and then it would stop, and then it would catch up. And we finally got to the other end, and she wasn't there. The kitchen truck wasn't there. Now, the way they worked it was like this. We were out on an old air base, an old German air base. And before we got there, a company of engineers had shown up and just stuck up tents they don't tie them down good, but they just stick them up in the air so that there's a place for you to go, and then you have to finish up the little details yourself. So when we got there, here's a company street with tents on it, you know, and company commander said, okay, this is going to be the kitchen, this is going to be the cook's tent next door, and then this is going to be first sergeant's, and so on and so on. And so these were like big tents. They would like take 25 men. They were what they call a squad tent. And so now we're there, but we can't go to sleep yet until the truck shows up, because we have to cook breakfast in the morning. Now, by now, it's like 2 o'clock at night. So Margaret's been in that truck now for 22 hours. Mm-hmm. And the truck finally shows up. Well, they had the company commander had designated a certain number of people to be to help the cooks clear the truck, and so they could prepare the kitchen for morning. So here's this big group of guys, and they're tired, and they want to go to sleep. And as soon as they get this truck unloaded, they're going to go to sleep, and there's maybe 15 or 20 of them. I mean, you know, they never spared any manpower in the service. So the truck backs up. Two Jeeps have got their headlights on the rear end of it, and they open up the back, and they're starting to throw stuff off like crazy. And I got I got to do something. I don't know what to do. So now the driver of this truck was not in our company. He was in a transportation company. So he didn't have to help with the unloading because it wasn't his job. And I went around the side of the truck and I said, well, I got to get her out. And I just took my knife and I cut the rope. I couldn't untie it. I cut the rope, flapped it back on the corner. I put the knife in my mouth. And I went up and got her. She couldn't stand up or do anything, and I pulled her out. Now, the truck driver came around the truck, and he saw me carrying this person out of the top of his truck. And his jaw just dropped wide open. And I looked at him. I had the knife in my mouth still. I was a harmless little guy. I'd never hurt anybody. He looked at that, and I said, you didn't see nothing. And he thought I was threatening him with the bayonet, you know. And he said, oh, I didn't see nothing. So we got her out, walked her around, put her in the cook's tent, stuck her in a sleeping bag. And all of a sudden somebody said, Cot, company commander wants to see you. Probably want some advice on how to run this company. I'll take care of that. I'm just in great spirits. I figured I've got away with it. And this Lieutenant Bear was an acting company commander, and he was a nice guy. And he brought me into the command tent there, and he said, Cot, you see these things on my shoulder? I don't want to lose them.
For 22 hours, and we're just at the point where the commanding officer says he doesn't want to lose.
Want to lose these bars.
Yeah.
So he said he didn't know what to do. If he brought it to light, it would have been. It was a real strong thing. They didn't care about us sneaking a few girls around, but not leaving Czechoslovakia, because that was an agreement between the Russians and the Americans. So, you know, he just said, get her out of here in the morning. So early that next morning, I dressed her up, put a big winter overcoat on her and a helmet liner, and we walked into the little village, and I went around from door to door until I could find somebody that would let her live there, and I offered to pay them, you know, with food and stuff. And so she slept there for quite a while, but the Americans were smart, and I wasn't the only one that had smuggled people out. It turned out that there were any number of them. And so what they did, they got to these little villages early in the morning, And they parked a Sherman tank at each end and just raided the villages and got the people to show all their papers. But since I was a cook and got up early, 4 o'clock, I knew it was going to happen, and I got all of the... I had brought this woman all kinds of things, you know, clothes that she could use for her kids, and got all of that stuff in a sack, because if they got caught with it in their house, they were in trouble. And we went out in the morning and slithered along the ground. I remember the ground, everything was covered with frost. Got out into the woods, and I heard a fellow say, "Halt, who goes there?" And I said, "Oh, it's just me." And I told Margaret to scoot off the other direction, and I'd come back in the afternoon and get her. And so, you know, you're like, "Just me, what does that mean? Who, what are you doing?" "Oh, you know, I was in here with my girl asleep, and I don't want to get caught." "Well, you better get out of here. Go on, beat it." So she didn't get caught, and it turned out that they rounded up about 15 other people. You know, there was no sign of it. You'd have never guessed, but... the other villagers said, "You know, as far as we know, you're the only one that got away with it. The rest of them got caught." So we stayed there, and eventually that was the purpose for going to that spot, was to leave to go home. So on the day that we were ready to leave to get on the truck to go to Le Havre and then get on the ship, I had Margaret all dressed up in her GI clothes out in the latrine, but there wasn't any way that it was going to work. I could see that it was just going to be absolutely impossible to smuggle her onto that ship and stuff. So I went, told the sergeant, I said, "I got to go to the latrine." "Yeah, well, hurry back." I had all our belongings, all packed in a big barracks bag, standing there in this big formation, waiting for the truck to come and pick us up. And so I went out to the latrine, and I gave Margaret all the money I had in my pocket and stuff, and she said, "Don't worry, I'll make it back to Vienna." And I said, "Well, I'm going to go home, get discharged, and I'm going to come back, and we're going to get married." She was pregnant by then with my first boy, Billy. And as I started walking back to the outfit, to the company street, I just felt so terrible. And, you know, up until that time, the only thing you could think of was, "I want to go home, home, I want to go home." And now, I didn't want to go home. I wanted to stay here with her. So I got an idea. As I was walking back, they can't move anybody with venereal disease. They have to put you in the hospital immediately. They cannot put you in with other people and move you. So I went back to the Red Cross tent, to the medics tent, and I said, "You know, gee, I just went to the latrine, I have clap." "Oh, what are we gonna do with you? We don't have any vehicles." "Now you find out." "Oh, well, you can't go home." "Oh gosh, that's too bad." "Oh, okay, here." He wrote up a piece of paper, and he said, "Take this over to the next company down here." You could see them from where we were standing. "Go to the doctor down there, tell him that we can't take you to the hospital, and you should be sent to the hospital." Well, I went to that place, and I went to another one after that. And everybody had the same excuse, because each one of these people were going home, but it was just the next day. So they were busy putting things in boxes and getting rid of them and signing papers. Eventually I figured out that the doctor in my outfit had taken me off the morning report, but the hospital didn't know I was coming. So I wasn't AWOL. I wasn't in the service anymore. I was in between the cracks. So the next morning, I got Margaret dressed up as a Polish refugee this time, with Polish stickers on her shoulder. They used to wear army clothes because they didn't have any other clothes, and they couldn't, you know, this would, so if they had to clothe these people, it had to be with army clothes. But they distinguished them by putting this thing that said Poland on the outside. So I dressed her up like that because they could drive in American vehicles. And we got back to Wiesburg. Now, as we were hitchhiking on the road, this big command car stopped. And then as soon as he saw her, he said, "Oh, I don't know if she can travel a car." And I showed him this fake document, you know, and he said, "Oh, well, sure, hop in." And he pulls into a place to eat at noontime. It was a big army, a German fort that with big walls around the outside, and they had barracks in there and stuff, and we'd taken them over and had a lot of people stationed there. But when you drove in, you know, it was like a guard at the entrance, and then when you were inside, you were like locked in. And so the driver jumps out and he says, "Come on, we're going to get something to eat." And I said, "Oh no, we have some K rations out here. We'll just stay out here." And he started to look kind of suspicious at us, you know, like, well, nobody would eat K rations if they could go in and get a hot meal. So I thought, you know, well, better not to look suspicious. I said, "Well, okay, let's go inside." We get up the stairs, and the mess sergeant's standing there, and he says, "Well, come on, hurry up. You have to go upstairs and sign in so I can draw rations on you tomorrow. Hurry up, because I'm breaking down the chow line." So we go upstairs in this building, and we go into this place, and here's a 35-year regular Army, not just drafted for the war, first sergeant. Knows all the regulations, knows all the papers and everything else. And he says to the driver, "Are these people with you?" "It's Margaret and me." And the driver, perfectly honest, he says, "Well, no, this is my trip ticket." And so he says, "Okay, where's your pass?" And I'm caught red-handed, and I don't know what to do. So I tell him, "Well, I don't have a pass because I'm on duty." "Well, what do you mean you're on duty?" "Oh, well, this young lady is with the Viennese consulate, and she travels from Vienna to Seine section in Paris." And I'm making this up as I go along. "What do you mean?" "Well, yes, they go back and forth. They're couriers, and I'm a guard. Each one of these girls gets a guard because, it's, you know, it's dangerous work." "Well, where's your travel orders? "Oh, well, you see, we're not supposed to leave the train." "Well, why did you leave the train?" "Well, you know, see, in those days, the tracks were so bombed out that it took sometimes days to go over what would be only an hour's travel."
Uh-huh.
Because you could only one train at a time could get through these bottlenecks. So it was perfectly feasible that you could leave the train and hitchhike down the road and catch up with it real easy. So I said, "That's what we were trying to do." He says, "Well, where's her papers then?" And I show him this document. Now, it's real nice and official looking, but he ain't never seen nothing like this in 35 years in the service, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So. So he picks up the phone and he calls down for a Dolmetscher. That's a translator. And I said, "I could translate for you." And he said, "Yeah, I'll bet you could." So I step over to see Margaret, and I tell her, "Everything's okay. Well, I'm going to get this straightened out in a minute." And I go back over to him, and I say, "The young lady would like to go to the bathroom." "Oh, George, take her out to the bathroom." So now they get kind of busy there, and phone's ringing, and they're starting to handle some other things. They're waiting for the translator to come up. And I step over to the door, open the door, slide out in the hall, find a frosted glass door that looks like a bathroom, see Margaret's silhouette behind it, grab her by the wrist, run out through this row of desks, down the stairs. At any one of these points, just the opening of the door and saying, "Stop those people," would have stopped us. Got down in the parade ground, grabbed our bag out of the back of the truck, and made it out the front door of this fort. And I'm just scared to death. And we get outside, and I quit jerking out a raincoat to put on so I'd look different. And a UNICEF truck from UNRWA, from the United Nations Relief Organization, full of grain, came by. And I jumped right out in front of it and stopped him. And he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to..." I forget where it was now, but it happened to be in our direction. But if he said the moon, I would have said, "That's where I'm going to." Uh-huh. And we got up in the cab of this truck, and it took off. Went right out into the country. And I thought it was all over. You know, I start to feel good again. And all of a sudden, a big truck passed us, goes up the road about a half a mile, parks across the road, and when we catch up with him, he's standing there with a gun. And you two with me. Well, I got this kid and I said, "Oh, please tell him you stopped, but we escaped," and everything else. He says, "I can't do that. Come on, you got to go back with me." So we went back and we went up to the same place again. And this staff sergeant, boy, he is all puffed up, boy. He has just foiled this thing. And what they thought was these Nuremberg trials were going on. Nuremberg is not far from Wiesbaden. It's only one next village, next city. And so they were very, very scared about the Nazis, you know, perhaps trying to foul up the trials and help escape, you know, something like that. So they thought maybe we were a couple of spies or something. And they arrested both of us. And By the time it came time to get put in front of the provost marshal, they changed shifts, and the people that brought us up before the provost marshal had a couple of drunks and me, and you know, you staggered up, and they held the drunks up in front of the provost marshal, and guilty, and I'm guilty, and. Asked me if I'm guilty. I said, "I don't think so." And the provost marshal says, "Don't be smart, young fella. You know whether you're guilty or not." I said, "Well, sir, I'm a high point man. I'm on the way home. The doctor told me I have venereal disease. I know for a fact I don't, and that I couldn't have, and he's mistaken, and I should be on my way home. I'm a high point veteran, and these guys arrested me trying to get to the hospital." Oh, well, he ripped them up one side and down the other and had me sent off to the hospital. And the doctor there helped me he made a couple of phone calls and got Margaret taken out of the venereal disease section of the jail. Uh-huh. And he gave me a test, and he called me and he says, "Look, if you promise me you'll go straight home, I'm going to let you walk out of here. And don't go getting that girl again and getting in trouble." "Oh, yes, sir." And, of course, I didn't. I got out. I got another paper to carry with me that showed me that he was sending me back without any venereal diseases. And I got a hold of Margaret, and we smuggled our way in the engines, in the electric engines of the trains, and we made it over the. We almost didn't make it at the Austrian border, but we made it, and I got her to her home in Vienna, which is in the Russian zone of Vienna. And then I left and got back on the Adelberg Express and started towards to turn myself in to try to get discharged and get back to marry her. One of the guys that was on the train with me said, "Well, you know what, Jerry, you can get discharged over here. You don't have to go all the way home and get discharge and then come back, and there's no ships coming back or anything. It's going to be hard, but you know, you got to apply for it." So when I got off the train in Seine section in Paris, I was going to look for a place to billet. I had no place to sleep or anything. So I went to an MP and I said, you know, I need help. I need a place to sleep. And how come you don't have any travel orders, any papers? And I don't know. Yeah, I better see my boss. Oh, well, he listens to this whole story and he starts to call people to find out what to do with me. And eventually, he gets somebody. He must have made 18 or 20 different phone calls. They all told him to try somebody else. So he finds the, I forget what it was called, Seine section PD or something like that. And he tells me to go out there to this place, and he gives me instructions on what subway to take and then get off and then walk 3 blocks, and there's the big building. When I knock on the door and the door opens and I step inside, I realize this is a penitentiary. It's a prison. And the people that are walking around in there have got army uniforms on, but they've been dyed bright red. It's a prisoner's to distinguish them. And so I tell the guy, oh, I think I'm in the wrong place. And he says, son, that door only swings one way. You're in. You're stay in.
Oh, how scary.
And now, I don't have any orders. I don't have any papers. So they have to first establish who I am. So I have to go in and give them all this information, and they see if I'm wanted or if I'm AWOL. Well, I'm not listed anywhere as AWOL. Now, this is a very severe military prison. You're not allowed to talk to these people. You can't say good morning to somebody. Silent at all times, only speak when you're spoken to and only answer what you're asked. Well, they put you in a holding tank for the first night. And this is an old factory. No, the glass has all been busted out of the windows, but the windows are, you know, small metal bars, so it acts like a prison. And so I decide that I don't like it here, and I don't think I want to spend the night. So we go to chow, and when I get back and get back in this holding tank, I keel over, and somebody runs over and says, what's wrong? And I say, appendicitis. Oh, and they rattle cups on the bars, and the cops come back in. And yeah, run him over to the dispensary. Now I'm, oh, in pain, oh, on and on. You know, I got myself so worked up that I was actually sick. And these two guys that ran the dispensary, one of them said to the other one, you know, that quack we got in here for a doctor, if he gets his hands on this kid, he'll kill him. Let's get him off to the hospital. He looks like a kid. So they quick short-circuited a bunch of stuff, and they got me in an ambulance and over to the hospital. And when I get there, they're all with gowns on and everything ready to operate. And I don't want to get operated on.
Yeah, really.
And I'm in this little booth where they examine you, you know, and the doctor says to the other, come here for a minute. He says, something's wrong here. You know, I don't think he has appendicitis. I think this is indigestion. And I don't think we ought to cut him open yet. And so they put me in up in a regular hospital bed, and it's nice and clean and white sheets and a pillow and everything. But it's prison. It's a prison hospital ward. Mm-hmm. And meet a bunch of interesting people there. And eventually, they let me out of this place, and they tell me to report to an old department store in the heart of Paris that they're using as a hotel for the GIs to sleep in while they're waiting for the trains.
So you weren't charged with anything?
No, I wasn't charged with anything because I wasn't wanted and I wasn't AWOL. And the documents that I carried showed that I was supposed to have venereal disease, and I don't. And so it was a big mistake, and everybody was saying, I'm sorry. But now we're in Paris now, and they sent me down to a building that the army had taken over.
And you had to swear out your records. You had to undertake an oath and then give your records, and, you know, which is, it was a, under penalty. If you lie about it, you're going to go, you know, it's a big thing. And one of the questions to prove that I had these number of points, I had to give a date. And I had some letters that I didn't have with me that would jog my memory so I could prove that I was at this spot at that time. So I said, I'll bring them in to you. And he said, well, yeah, go home and get them and come back tomorrow. So when I came back, I gave him that information, and he gives me a brown envelope with my new records in them. And he says, take these to your company commander, and he'll send you home. As I'm walking down the hall, I see a sign on a door that says marriages and discharges. It was an old manila file folder, and it was scotch taped to the door with handwritten. And I thought, this has got to be a joke. What do they mean, marriages and discharges? So I opened the door, and it was a guy sitting inside with his feet up on the desk and a newspaper over his face. And he said, yeah, what do you need? And I said, well, I want to get discharged and married. He said, well, you came to the right place. What do you mean? He said, oh, well, a lot of guys are marrying French girls, and they get a job here. And he said, oh. So I tell him, well, Lee, the girl I want to marry is from Vienna. And he says, nah, that wouldn't work. They would never approve that. He said, well, I'll tell you what we can do. This officer that comes in here and rubber stamps these, I do all the paperwork. Now, we'll have to be truthful about it. We'll have to say she's from Austria. But I'll stick it in with about 200 applications. He never reads them. He just rubber stamps everything I put in front of him. So I think we can get this done. But he says, here's the thing. If you give these, your records, to your company commander, he's going to have you on the next train leaving Paris for the boat. So I said, well, I don't know what to do about that. And he grabs my records and he sticks them in his desk drawer, and he said, they just got lost. So if you don't have any records, they can't move you. So during this process...
Now, did you have to pay him to do anything like
that? No, this was just buddy system in the service, you know. Okay. Eventually, I got discharged out of this place on the day of my birthday, February 7th, 1945. And
well, it must have been was it 46?
Well, I think it was late 40. I think it was late 45. I was 21. No, 46. I was 21. Yeah, that's right. I was 21. I was old enough to get married. And so I lost my train of thought for a second, but in order to get discharged in France, I had to, this was a process we were doing unbeknownst to anybody else, in cahoots with this sergeant that mm-hmm. had gotten, that ran the marriages and discharges office. And there was a girl out in the corridor, and I had to get permission from the French government. I had to go and make a formal application. They were going to give it to me, but you had to go in and make a formal application and swear that you wouldn't be a burden on the French people, and you'd take mm-hmm. care of yourself and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And so while I was doing that, there was this girl sitting there next to me out in the hall. You don't have waiting rooms. You wait out in the hall on a big bench. And, you know, she was trying to strike up a conversation with me, and I wasn't on the make at all, you know, but finally she said, listen, I got to ask you a question. I'm Latvian, and every 6 months I have to renew my permission to stay in France as a foreigner. But surely every American soldier doesn't have to come in here and get permission to stay in France. Oh, no. I'm trying to marry a girl from Vienna, and I need to get discharged here so I can go back and get her. And she said, I'm trying to marry an American soldier. We're in love and everything, but I can't prove who I am because my documents are all up in Germany, and you can't get into Germany. It's an occupied country. There's no way to get in. So I said, oh, yeah, there's a way to get in. Well, she said, could you get me into Germany? Yeah, it wouldn't be hard. I could do that. So the next day, I took her down to the Gare du Sud and in a taxi. She was staying in a hotel called the Hotel Splendide. And she told me that it was inexpensive and clean and stuff. And so I took her down in a taxi and told the driver to go a block past the station. We walked in back of the station, down to the tracks. Now, the platform, there was a leave train that went to Munich, from Paris to Munich, every day at noon. And this was one of those old Victorian stations with the glass roof over the top. And they wouldn't bring the locomotive in, a steam locomotive with smoke coming out, until the last minute to save all the smoke coming inside. So they had the train inside, and they had MPs at every gate getting in, but nobody out on the tracks. So when the locomotive came along the tracks, we just walked right alongside the locomotive and up into the station, opened the first car on the train, put her inside. She had kind of GI clothes on, and said goodbye and good luck. Her name was Anya Suzanne. And I left and got discharged from the service, and I got on that very train. The next day after I got discharged, I was on that very train, smuggled my way back up into Munich, and from Munich to Salzburg, and from Salzburg into the Russian zone of Austria, and into the town of Vienna. Now, I've got a discharge from the army, but you weren't allowed to do all this traveling. And then I went to the Russians and I got a ration card, and they were very nice. The Russian said to me, he spoke English, and he spoke quite good English. And he said, look, young man, you obviously have no respect for your own country's laws because you broke all of them to get here. But I guarantee you, you will have respect for my laws, because if you break any, I'm going to put you in prison. There's not going to be a trial. You're going to prison. Just don't break any rules. But we'll share our food with you. And he gave me ration stamps. And we lived for several weeks in Vienna. Now, what I would do is put my uniform on, and go into town, go to any military installation I could find, a hospital, anything, and go inside and steal all the food I could find any place of any shape, size, or description. And if I couldn't find any food, I could find overcoats, I could find blankets, I could find pajamas, I could find bathrobes, and they were all saleable on the black market. And I'd go to the Red Cross and get donuts. You weren't allowed to take them out. You'd put them in front of you, and I slip them in my shirt. My shirt's all full of powdered sugar. I got a rash on my forehead. So I went into Vienna, and I went to an army hospital, and the doctor looked at me and said, young man, that's impetigo, that's a contagious disease, you can't leave. And I said, oh, doc, I'm an American, but I'm not a soldier. And my uniform had no insignias on it. I just wore the uniform. And he said, I don't care. This is an American hospital. You're an American. You're not going outside with a communicable disease. Now, right away, they have a problem, because you can't mix civilians with soldiers. You can't mix officers with enlisted men. So they put me, don't know where to put me, and they put me in with a reporter from the New York Times. He's a civilian. And he hears this story about a kid that gets discharged over there, can't get back home because they won't let him, or bring his wife. And he files the story. And of course, the Army censors everything. They couldn't print anything without passing censor. And a they decide that he can't print the story. So they send me a letter. It took 2 weeks to get across the town of Vienna. In those days, it was, the mail was so slow. Mm-hmm. And the letter went something like this, you know, dear Mr. Cott, there may be a way in which, if you will cooperate with the Army, there may be a way in which we might straighten this thing out and get you sent home. So please come into the State Department. So I went into the State Department. They had an embassy open by then. And they said, look, we don't even know if you're an American. You speak English, but we have no proof who you are. Your discharge is no photograph on it or anything. Mm-hmm. But we're willing to believe that you're who it says you are in this thing, and that you served your country. And you can't leave here without a passport. So they issued me the fourth passport out of Vienna in that year. The other three were given to Americans that had hidden out in attics during the entire war. And the minute it was over, they went in and got sent home. Now all we had to do was get visas to enter Switzerland and France. And Margaret didn't have any papers. So I said, I'm not going without her. Oh, they tried everything to persuade me to go. Finally, and I just said, I'm not going to, they said, okay, here's what we'll do. And she just shows you when they want to solve the problem, it's so easy. They put a piece of paper in a typewriter and they write down all the following facts. This is Margaret Acott. She's born of so and so and so on such a day and such a parish. And such a date, and so forth and so on. And due to the fact that there is no Austrian government, this letter will act in lieu of a passport. They pasted a stamp on the bottom of it. It looked like a postage stamp, but it wasn't. It was some other kind of stamp. And then they canceled the stamp, and it becomes a legal document, and we will come right back to the United States with it. I think
amazing.
I've still got it somewhere.
And
In those days, the loophole was this. The wife of a GI didn't need a visa to enter the United States. They did not specify that it had to be a wife from France or England, because that's where all the GIs married. They married French girls and English girls. Those were our allies.
Mm-hmm.
But but you couldn't marry a German or an Austrian girl, was not allowed. She couldn't even apply for it. And anyway, this general that gave me that finally agreed to, he said, if you'll tell us how you crossed the borders, because we're of the opinion that nobody could do that, and we had walked across those borders so many times, it was ridiculous. And they were having the Nuremberg trials at that time, and so they felt that nobody could get through. And I said, "This is ridiculous," and I had to show them how I did it, and they were just flabbergasted. It was so easy to do, you know. So that's when Margaret and I left Vienna and we got to Paris, and I went to one of the cheapest hotels I could find, because I had to support myself, you know, and it was hard. Oh, yeah. Oh, I was living on whatever I could steal from the Army. I lost my train of thought again. Okay, so we went to this horrible, 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 crappy hotel. Dirty. Now, Margaret was not a complainer. She never bitched or complained about anything. And I can still remember standing there looking out this dismal view out the window, And Margaret said, Jerry, this has got to be the lowest ebb of our, you know, every place we've stayed was nicer than this. Can't we find something better than this? And I remembered, yeah, the Hotel Splendide, where Anna Suzanne, where I helped her get back in. And I remembered how to get there on the subway. And I went there and I rented a room. I got her upstairs in the room, and I remembered that there was a little restaurant across the street. And I said, hey, let's go get a bowl of soup over there. So we went out. Now, this place had a birdcage elevator, you know, with this open wrought iron type mm-hmm. cage. Mm-hmm. And the stairs kind of went around the elevator all the way up to the fifth, you know, I think it was 5 stories high. So we went out and pressed the button for the elevator, and up comes the elevator, and who do you suppose is standing on the elevator? Anna Suzanne and her GI husband. And she looks at me, and she says, Jerry. And I, Anna. Margaret has no idea who she is. And this GI is with her. Who's this guy? What? Now, the elevator doesn't stop. It keeps going, you know. And so we're running around the stairs. I got Margaret by one hand, yanking her up around. And where are we going? Why are we putting... and the elevator doors open up, and we take a big hug. And she introduces me. This is the guy that made it possible for us to get married, honey. He's, you know, oh, well, fine. And they got there within an hour of us getting into that hotel. Isn't that unbelievable?
It is.
Unbelievable. Just completely, you know, you couldn't believe that it would come, not even a day later or a week later, the same day, within an hour. So we became good friends, and they stayed. We were both waiting. She was waiting for a bride ship, he was waiting for a troop ship, and we were waiting for a civilian ship to take us back. And I had to pay the fare back myself, and it had to be paid in dollars in the States. You couldn't pay with it with the play money over there in France. And so we stayed together for about 6 weeks. And this guy was real smart. We would go down to the PX, and you could buy money orders with French money. You could buy a $100 money order with French francs, but it was cashable in dollars. And the money order comes with two parts, the part that's the money and the part that's the receipt. If the guy that sold it to you was a civilian, French civilian, and he was running a black market operation where you buy the money order, pay for it, and you give it back to him, and he gives you twice the value, 200 in francs. So we would go in every day and buy and sell a money order and double our money, and that paid for our hotels and taxis and running around. We didn't live high, but we lived good. Eventually, our ship came, and we took a train to Le Havre, to Cherbourg. And as we left, the ports were all blown up and sunken ships left and right, and our ship was leaving. We looked across the fantail, and there was, I think we saw his ship, the troop ship, first, and he was standing there waving at us. And we went by another ship, and there she was on that ship with a bunch of women.
Anna.
Mm-hmm. Both left at the same day, they went back. He was from Old English, Iowa. So when Margaret and I drove out to California, I looked on the map and I saw Old English, and I said, look, that's only a little ways out of our way. It was about an hour's trip out of the way. We drove over there, and it was his mother was there, and I asked for them, and she said, that girl isn't going to stay in a place like Old English, Iowa. She thinks she's going to become a movie star in the United States, and they're off in Hollywood. So she gave us a beautiful lunch, and we took off and came to San Francisco, But, you know, that's a long ways down to Hollywood, so we never got to go down there. And finally, when we did, we looked them up, and they were still married. And I've never seen them since. That was the last time I've ever seen them. I've lost track of them completely. So,
well, that's quite a story. Quite a story.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? That's quite an adventure, yeah.
So then, all right. So
now I'm in San Anselmo. Yeah,
now you got to San Anselmo through your mother who rented a house there.
She
bought a house there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you and Margaret moved in with your mother? Is that how?
No, we towed a trailer with us. We had a house trailer.
And then you went to Alto.
But I didn't have a car. I didn't have a car, but I had the trailer in my mother's car. She flew out here with my brother.
Oh, I
and,
see.
And uh-huh. That's all I brought the car out for. We moved into the trailer park in Alto. And I already had a union card, which is another long story you don't want to hear. But I had by accident gotten that. And I wasn't a carpenter by any means. I mean, I went to trade school and I learned how to build a waste paper basket, but I didn't know anything about building houses. I had a box full of tools and I had a union card.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to go to work right away. I had a boy. My baby was born then. Billy was born in Yonkers. He was born in the same hospital that I was. And so I went right to work. And I couldn't keep a job longer than a day. Mostly, if I got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, by noon they were handing me a check saying, hit the road.
And why was that?
Because I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea. I had no idea what I was doing. You know? It was absurd. I mean, they would tell me cut a board, and I can cut a board. I mean, I wasn't completely stupid, but I didn't know how to build a house. I didn't know what carpenters did. Drove nails into wood, but, you know. But I could get a job. It was easy to get the job because they'd hire anybody that came along. But like I say, along about noon, they'd say, well, we're not that hard up. you're gone. Well, one night, and I was doing fine. I was able to live all right because I could get a day's pay every day pretty much. Some places I'd last more than a day. But I got to figuring it out, you know, and I thought, you know, you better learn something because this shortage of people is not going to be around forever. And I was driving home, and they were just opening up Greenbrae. And it was about 5 o'clock at night. Everybody'd gone home, and I saw the superintendent's shed, a little lumber yard there. And I dropped in. I said, hey, you looking for any carpenters? And he looked out the door and he said, yeah, do you know any? I said, well, me. He said, oh. He smiled and he says, are you a finished carpenter or a rough carpenter? And I said, I'm a rough carpenter and I don't know anything at all about it. But you know what? If you show me what to do, I'll be here every day. I'll work hard. And he smiled and he said, well, that's refreshing. Almost everybody's got a BS story to give me. And, you know, an old timer can just smell out another mechanic. Lost my train of thought again.
So that was in Greenbrae, you said?
That was in Greenbrae. That's what it was. Okay, with Greenbrae. So I thought to myself, you know, I haven't given this guy any BS. So, and he says to me, well, leave your name and address and I'll call you. And I thought, well, sure you will. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can just see you doing that. And I started to leave. And he says, aren't you going to leave your name and address? And I said, oh, yeah, sure, here it is. And sure enough, my wife got home a couple of nights later, and Margaret says to me, did you get fired again? And I said, well, yeah, but I'll get a job in the morning. She said, well, there was a guy here looking for you, had a job for you. And I went back the next day, and Gordon Hancock from Schultz Company was in the shed, and I was there real early in the morning. He said, well, son, he said, this is a union job, you know, nothing starts here until 8 o'clock. Not 5 minutes to 8 o'clock. So I said, well, that's okay with me. So he says, look, he says, go across the street and start stripping those forms over there. Now, there's a job that, I mean, any donkey can do. So I went over there, and I wanted to impress him so much. I wanted to show him what a hard worker I was, and I got a sledgehammer out of a tool shed, and I was just wailing back and forth, knocking everything into little splinters and getting that wood off those forms. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, son, you're not going to last till noon doing that. Look how easy these things come off. You don't need this sledgehammer to do it. And he showed me how to just walk downstream, and the thing just falls apart. So about noon, he comes over and he says, listen, young fella, you can read blueprints, can't you? And I thought, oh, God, I'm going to lose another job. All I want to do is be the lowest man on the totem pole, not make a lot of noise, not be noticed. And so that's not going to work. And
so did you have to read the blueprints?
I can read a blueprint, but I wasn't sure that I could. Uh-huh. And so he hands me a set of prints and he says, this is the house we're going to build, only it's going to be left instead of right. Means it's a mirror image. So I walked around, and he wants me to lay out this house. The floor's all down, and I'm supposed to lay out this house, and I got a picture of the house. But you have to put it up like this to make it right. So I'm walking around like this, trying to get the spots. Uh-huh. And I'm scared to death. To lay out a house, you really have to know what you're doing. And I didn't, and I knew I didn't. But you know, the superintendent, the next day I started to lay out a house, and the framing foreman came around and he says, hey, who told you to be layout man? Well, Gordon did. Oh, well, Gordon did. That's the boss. Well, hurry up. Get this laid out because my crew has to be down here to build it. You got to lay it out. Hurry up. Do it fast. Well, I didn't know how to do it fast. I was scared to death that if I put a mark down, it would be the wrong place, and I'd fidget with it and mark again and measure and everything else. And finally, the assistant superintendent showed up, and he said, who the hell hired you and told you you were layout man? Gordon. Oh, well, that's different. And Gordon came over, and he said, listen, Ole, I got a feeling that if we teach him how to do everything, he'll do it our way. And we won't have to be fighting with the people to do it. It'll only be our way. And so he just held my hand and showed me how to do everything, very patiently brought me through the whole process. Now, it didn't take very long before I was a good layout man. And if you can lay it out, anybody can build it. But it's the laying out that's the thing. And that was the start. That was how I got my start. I maybe couldn't drive nails as fast as somebody else, but I could lay it out better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's how...
That's how you got your building start.
That's how I got the building start.
Well, I know that, so I remember seeing pictures in the history room of that trailer park in Alto.
I might have some of those, I'm not sure. I'm sure I do if I look far enough.
If you have pictures of early Mill Valley,
mm-hmm.
That we could copy. We have,
of course,
a process.
Yeah. I brought a lot of stuff here for you to look at.
Great. That's terrific. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about, so you got to Mill Valley in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
That's 60 years.
Yeah.
So, how long was it before you were building your own houses? Because I remember talking.
It was in the early 50s, about 1950. Uh-huh. I was building, I after I worked in Green Bay for about 3 months, my mother was starting to build a house. I convinced her that I could build her a house. And I would hire the guys that I worked with all day long to come and work for me on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And the lumber yard that furnished the lumber, he noticed that I was an active little guy and that I was always in there every Friday night to have a big load of stuff delivered for Saturday morning. And he said, "Listen, Jerry."
And now, what lumber yard was that?
Not here?
What lumber yard was
that? Oh, McCormick and Tucker. They're not here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
McCormick Tucker. Now this was Mr. Tucker. He had bought out McCormick, and it was all his now. He said, "Jerry, look." He said, he brought me out in his yard, and he says, "You see this pile of lumber here?" And it was kind of crappy looking, you know, a little crooked and maybe big knots and stuff. And he said, "I paid top dollar for that, but when people come in here, they select those out. They say, 'Oh, I don't want that one.'" And so he said, "I could furnish you with all of this lumber, and you put up some land, and we'll take this lumber and we'll build a house, and then we'll sell it unfinished. We'll put a stack of sheetrock in it, we'll frame it up and sell it. Somebody will buy it, we'll split the money." So I didn't have to put up any money, you know. And we got a lot for not much money down, and $500, as a matter of fact, in San Anselmo.
San Anselmo.
Yep.
$500 down.
Well, he put $500 was the price of the lot, and we got that fronted to us. Yeah.
Amazing.
We paid for the lot when the house was done and sold. So we actually hadn't lay any money out of my pocket at all, and he furnished the windows and all this lumber. And stuff, and we built this. That was a start. I got the building permit. Well, now, when we got up and back at Tam High School, there was a gym teacher by the name of, gosh, I could have said it a second ago, Jerry. No, all right, this guy, he was the gym teacher, it'll come to me later on, in Tamalpais High School. And he used to stand down there in the athletic field, look up at the hill in back of the school, and the lower part of the hill had a lot of houses on it, but the upper part of the hill was empty. And he said, "You know, those are all lots up there. It's all been subdivided. I'm going to start sending out postcards and letters out to all these people all over the United States, and I'll offer them a price for these lots, because people are going to want that land after the war's over." So he got control of a big percentage, not all of it, but he got, you know, over half, and put some rough bulldoze some streets in, and he'd park his car up there on weekends and sell these lots off to people. And he'd seen me around, and he said, "Jerry, I'll sell you this lot down at 30 Morning Sun, and I'll sell it to you for nothing down, and you can pay me when a year later when you get the house built and financed." I had no idea how to finance anything or anything like that, but I just said, "Well, you know, I can get the lot. I'll start there." And so I built this thing on weekends and evenings, and we took our trailer and we moved out of Alto, and I towed the trailer over the land in back of the lot. We didn't actually own it. You couldn't do it now because it's got houses on it, but it was just empty then. We just drove over it and parked the trailer. I'm sure it was illegal on our lot there. And I built this beautiful house there. It was the first one I ever built on my own. Of course, I got all my guys from work to come and work on the weekends and help me put it up Saturdays and Sundays and stuff. And I built it strictly with the idea of selling it. And Margaret kind of fell in love with it. We were living in this little dinky trailer, and now we had the baby, and the baby was getting big. And so Margaret said, "Father, couldn't we move in that house?" And I said, "Sure, we can." And by that time, through Jerry Wendering, that was his name. Jerry Wendering was the guy that was the school teacher. He fronted me a couple of other lots up on Midway Avenue. Mm-hmm. And I started to design the house myself, and I built one that looked like a red barn. I thought it would look cute to have a red and white with a gambrel roof on it and a hayloft door on the top and stuff. And it was so popular, people would drive by, you know, and honk the horn and say, "Hey, that's great." And I thought I was onto something. So the next thing, I got a lot on the Tiburon Boulevard, but very close to the Mill Valley, to the Strawberry area over there. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Tiburon Road was just two lanes, and this huge, big lot I got there from Podesta Divers in Deep Sea Divers in San Francisco. They sold it to me for $1,500, which was a lot then, mm-hmm. a lot of money. And nothing down, and a year to build a house and get it sold. And I built another red barn there. And lo and behold, the San Francisco Chronicle put a half-page picture of that red barn. It was really, really picturesque thing there. I've got the newspaper down here.
Great.
In the Sunday Examiner or Chronicle, I'm not sure anymore. It'll say on the paper. All of a sudden, you know, I couldn't have paid for that kind of publicity. All of a sudden, you know, when I walked in the bank, it was, "Oh, hi, Mr. Cott. Yeah, we saw your house there in a Chronicle, and oh, yes, and be sure, can we help you with anything, you know?" And the next thing you know, I was borrowing money, then I lost my job up in Green Bay. They had a little recession, and they had built a huge number of houses there. They about developed all they wanted to. And I was the last person to get laid off up there. They had it down to the assistant superintendent, the superintendent, and me. And then I got fired. It was just before Christmas. And I went to work for another contractor who was building the most beautiful houses you'd ever want to see. And he helped me a lot in the style and design of things. And then I got hooked up through Jerry Wendering with some other empty land, and I was starting to build things, but I had no license. And there was a guy that was kind of jealous of me because I was building a lot of stuff, and it's a long story. But he turned me into the union for building on weekends and evenings, you're not allowed to do. He turned me into the state contractor's license board. He turned me into the district attorney's office in San Rafael for operating without a license.